Dennis and Margie, many of you will know through the ministry of Ransom Fellowship and through their publication Critique magazine. They have been teachers to me through their writings, and I know to many of you as well. Dennis and Margie together founded Ransom Fellowship with the purpose of helping Christians not to react to culture, but to engage it in a meaningful and winsome way. And for many years, they have led us in doing just that. So we rejoice in their presence here with us. That was a delight to have time with them at home last night together. And it's wonderful to bring them to you this evening. Before Dennis comes and gives his talk, I don't want to steal his thunder, but I do want to draw attention to this particular publication that's out there on the table. One of Square Halo's many fabulous books is this book, It Was Good, Performing Arts to the Glory of God. This is one of a trilogy of books. I think a very helpful, important series of books reflecting Christianly on the arts by wonderful thinkers and practitioners. And Dennis has a chapter in here dealing with story. So it's very fitting that he is here to lead us this evening. Dennis, thank you for traveling from Minnesota, and Margie to be with us. Please come and speak to us now.
It's really good of you to give up a Friday night to come to something like this. I'm glad you're here. I'm looking forward to it. I want to start with a quotation from Dr. Ordway. It's always good to quote the main speaker. She says this in her book, "We have an innate need for meaning in our lives. Because we are creatures who inhabit time, and importantly, who perceive the passing of time, we need to have this meaning expressed in a fundamentally narrative form. And as a result, we are predisposed to take in truth in the form of narrative and to use narrative forms to reflect on, process, and act on those truth claims." I think that's correct. And I would state it like this. Storytelling gains its significance and power as an art form because life and reality are inexplicable apart from narrative. Everyone has a story. Everyone lives in a story, and everyone is shaped by stories. From a biblical perspective, story is essential to human life and reality, the way we try to make sense of things in a broken world. And story can be used for either blessing or for curse. And since film and creative television is the most popular form of imaginative storytelling in our world, I want in this lecture tonight to identify some of the dynamics involved to help us as we reflect together on imagination, story, and the gospel. The essential nature of narrative is why children are instinctively drawn to stories. It's not simply that stories are entertaining, but that stories help them make sense of life in our beautiful, bewildering, and broken world. One time when she was quite young, our oldest granddaughter picked out a book and curled up on the couch beside me. "Read it, Grandpa," she said, and I did. When I reached the final page, she said, "Read it again, Grandpa." So I did. And on the last page, she repeated her request once again. Now, being the sort of grandfather I am, the third reading introduced some very small changes into the narrative. Nothing too drastic, you understand, just subtle shifts in minor details, not all that important to the plot. I had discovered up to this point that bigger changes would elicit a deep sigh and taking the book over to Grandma, which needed to be avoided at all possible costs. So I introduced my little changes as I read, and each time my granddaughter would interrupt me to correct me. "No, Grandpa," she said, "that's not right. It's blue, not gray." And she would say this from where she was laying under the afghan beside me. She was too young to read at the time, and she wasn't looking at the pictures, but not one of my changes slipped past her. You see, she wanted me to reread that story, not because she didn't know it, but because somehow it resonated deeply within her heart, mind, and imagination. And that is the power of story. And to see the power of narrative and story in the movies, let's watch a film clip together. It's from the 2016 movie Sully, directed by Clint Eastwood and starring Tom Hanks as Captain Sullenberger. And even if you didn't see the film, you probably know the story because it was in the news. On January 15, 2009, U.S. Airways Flight 1549 took off from LaGuardia Airport in New York. 3 minutes into the flight, a bit northeast of the George Washington Bridge, the plane hit a flock of Canadian geese, and it knocked out both engines on the Airbus A320. Captain Sully and First Officer Jeff Skiles, played by Aaron Eckhart in the film, successfully landed the plane on the Hudson River. The temperature that day was below freezing. 7 ferry boats with 130 commuters on board and hundreds of first responders rescued all 155 passengers and crew within 24 minutes. Now, the film clip that I'm going to show you begins just after the plane hits the geese and begins the emergency descent. And since you know the story, I have an assignment for you. It's very simple. Try not to be drawn in. Okay? Try your best to be aloof and withdrawn as you watch the story that unfolds. After all, you know how it's going to end. Okay? Just watch. So, how did you do? Were you able to remain aloof and detached, not drawn in, slightly bored, as you watch the clip? I doubt many of us would answer yes to that question. I know the story. I remember the day it occurred. I've seen the film more than once. I worked on extracting this film clip in order to show you, and I still find myself moved by what the scene depicts. This is the power of imaginative storytelling in film. It's in the movies that competing visions of reality, alternative worldviews and lifestyles, and differing answers to the perennial questions of existence are considered, explored, and made plausible or not. Penny Dreadful tells a story in which old Western literary myths, Frankenstein, werewolf as the hound of heaven, and Dracula, suggest that supernatural powers of evil are arrayed against humankind. Stranger Things suggests that forces greater than we can possibly imagine might be at work in the shadows of modern society beyond our ability to control. Manchester by the Sea explores how tragedy and guilt distorts lives and perspectives, producing ripples that fan out over time and across generations. Silence, based on the classic novel by Shusaku Endo, tells the story of persecution that drives Christians in 17th century Japan to hide their faith and find God in the silence in the face of their horrific suffering. Hidden Figures tells the true story of people made in God's image, marginalized by racism in our society, and who are yet crucial for some of the grandest scientific exploits of that society. Hacksaw Ridge explores what it means to be a person of conscience, even when that person's convictions are despised and vilified as traitorous and cowardly by everyone else. Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, written by J.K. Rowling, uses fantasy to confirm what I, as a child, knew instinctively, that strange powers and creatures, some good and others very bad, actually exist and make a difference, even though my parents scoffed and told me not to worry because there's nothing hiding in the darkness. The reluctant fundamentalist asks questions that are relevant to today's news headlines. Since at best we know only in part, what does it mean to see only part of someone's story, especially if that person is other, so very different from us? And how do we live and love in a world where competing fundamentals and beliefs are passionately believed, but that threaten to violently tear apart the delicate fabric of civilization? The film clip we just watched from Sully demonstrates the shape and trajectory of stories that allow us to understand both their essential nature and why they so powerfully draw us in. First, we're drawn into story because we are creatures living within the passage of time. And so just as that film clip had a beginning and a middle and an end, so do we, just as stories do. And so we instinctively fit in them. We are drawn in because stories follow a trajectory that reflects our experience of life in a broken world. Stories always include an element of tension that must be resolved, and in doing so echoes the deep yearning we have for redemption from the alienation, fragmentation, failure, and disappointment that always lurks in the shadows, bringing tension that we cannot escape. The creativity we enjoy in storytelling infuses this trajectory with details that paint a picture that engages our imagination. We learn of some setting, some context, whether fantastic or realistic, that defines the normal of the story. An occasioning event occurs, introducing tension, and then complications bring the tension towards some climax when we hope that some hero or healing will appear to bring resolution and allow life to go on, even if a bit changed from where things were when they started. And we are drawn into story because we are in a greater story. The story that the gospel tells, the true story unfolding in history that defines the trajectory of all human stories. Creation, fall, redemption, and restoration is not an exotic doctrinal nicety that Christians believe is a matter of ritual to belong to a club called the church. Rather, it is a definition of the reality in which all human beings live and move and have their being. This is why an apologetics shaped by the fourfold story of creation, fall, redemption, and restoration has something substantial to say to every human story, to every aspect of life and culture, to every idea, philosophy, and worldview under the sun. Biblical dramas, Dandurioni says, do not follow the patterns of literary dramas because someone massaged the stories to make them fit. Rather, God has structured human nature and creation so that certain elements are present in all stories worth telling. If biblical dramas have the same structure as fiction, it is because art imitates life, not because the Bible imitates art. So, when we look at the movies, we find stories that depict ordinary life in such a way that competing worldviews, values, convictions, and lifestyles are made attractive or unattractive, plausible or implausible. But that isn't all. We also find the great myths of mankind, most often implicitly depicted metaphorically, but sometimes depicted explicitly. These myths touch on something deep in the human experience and consciousness. They are rooted in the perennial questions that each generation and each culture and ultimately each person must either answer or intentionally suppress. For example, there is Arrival, the 2016 science fiction movie that implicitly, in both imagery and plot, is actually an inverted version of the biblical story of the Tower of Babel, addressing unity and fragmentation through misunderstanding in language. And then there is the even more explicit experience of myth in Doctor Strange, directed by the evangelical Christian director Scott Derrickson, in which the unseen supernatural world is actually integrated with the material seen world. I believe this is a fascinating time to be a Christian in the West. On the one hand, our society celebrates a secular social imaginary, while on the other, our society's movies celebrate gods goddesses, and heroes with supernatural powers to save humankind. The three Thor movies have grossed worldwide so far close to $2 billion. It is not strange that the old Norse myths would resurface in American culture, because I believe that secularism is ultimately a disappointing world in my view. It is hard to live in a world without windows. And it turns out that the Norse myths have an impact on us that's already greater than most of us would imagine. The names of the week in English, as a matter of fact, are named after Norse gods and goddesses, with Thursday being, of course, Thor's day. These are the myths that shaped C.S. Lewis's imagination and that he said prepared him for the gospel. Consider Thor, the Dark World. The opening credits make clear that this is a film rooted in the comics. That was the place where, decades ago, the old Norse god Thor was introduced to new generations of young readers like myself. The impressive special effects help us to believe that more than ordinary things are at work. Ancient myth is explicitly recounted in the dialogue. It's talked about so that the Norse myths are actually part of the plot and the dialogue of what takes place. And it provides a basis for light and dark, good and evil, and it hints at mysterious powers being at work in the cosmos. Evil is depicted as very real and deadly, and both gods and humankind must be on their guard if the darkness is not to finally overwhelm the light. There's more films that I could mention, but I'll just stop here because of time. By the way, Tim Keller points out, correctly I think, that in contrast to the pagan creation myths, the biblical doctrine of creation reveals God creating not as an act of power to fight against rebellion. Most of the creation myths start with the notion of a great rebellion, darkness overcoming the light, evil overcoming the good. They see creation as coming out of that great struggle as an expression of the gods and goddesses' power. But the biblical doctrine of creation reveals God creating not as an act of power in response to evil, darkness, or rebellion. Instead, he creates out of desire, out of love, as an act of the imagination. And since we're made in the image of this God, this means that creativity and imagination are key to what will give and bring true meaning and purpose in life. We need to open our imagination as Christians to the importance of myth. Listen to what C.S. Lewis says in his essay, Myth Became Fact. Now, as myth transcends thought, incarnation transcends myth. The heart of Christianity is a myth which is also a fact. The old myth of the dying God, without ceasing to be myth, comes down from the heaven of legend and imagination to the earth of history. It happens at a particular date in a particular place, followed by definable historical consequences. We pass from a Balder or an Osiris dying nobody knows when or where to a historical person crucified. It is all in order under Pontius Pilate. By becoming a fact, it does not cease to be myth. That is the miracle. Those who do not know that this great myth became fact when the Virgin conceived are indeed to be pitied. But Christians also need to be reminded that what became fact was a myth, that it carried with it into the world of fact all the properties of a myth. God is more than a god, not less. Christ is more than Balder, not less. We must not be ashamed of the mythical radiance resting on our theology. Stories make ideas plausible. And stories rooted in the great myths speak the deepest yearnings of the human heart. Those yearnings are rooted in the great perennial questions that every culture, generation, and every person ultimately must face. Is there meaning and purpose? What's gone wrong? What's the solution? what happens at death, is there a God, and so on and so forth. I'll close with one more film clip. It's a scene from a movie called Wit, and it captures a great deal of what we're talking about this weekend. As the film opens, Vivian Baring, a 43-year-old college professor played by Emma Thompson, is informed by her physician that she has terminal cancer. "I have stage 4 ovarian cancer," she says in the film. "There is no stage 5. The entire film unfolds in Vivian Baring's hospital room as she undergoes a grueling round of experimental chemotherapy, which does not destroy the tumor, but which makes her horribly sick. She's an English professor, a scholar specializing in the holy sonnets of the 16th century Christian poet John Donne. "Death, be not proud, though some have called thee mighty and dreadful, for thou art not so. For thou whom thou think'st thou dost overthrow, die not, poor death, nor yet canst thou kill me. One short sleep past, we wake eternally, and death shall be no more. Death, thou shalt die." Throughout the film, we listen as she muses on this poem, this time not as a scholar analyzing a text and arguing in learned literature whether Donne used a comma or a semicolon and what it means, but as a person living in the face of death. For years, she has spurned human relationships, sacrificing everything for her work and scholarship. But now she yearns for nothing more than in these final moments of life, there would be somebody there for her. In one flashback to her student days in college, we see her mentor, the great E.M. Ashford, try to help her understand that the poem is not about wit. Donne is not engaging in clever wordplay about unsolvable paradoxes in the human experience. He's exploring truth about life and death. But Vivian Baring would have none of it. "I thought being smart was the thing," she says, "but I was found out." For 8 months, she is in that hospital room and has not a single visitor. Then finally, by the end of the film, she's near death, and her suffering has been intense. And then her old professor, long forgotten in the movie, stops by for a visit. That, I submit, is an imaginative apologetic.